Hey, Trojan fans, it's time to get into the huddle with the Peristyle Podcast. The Peristyle Podcast is your weekly ticket to USC football and recruiting news. Don't forget, you can download the podcast 24/7 at our website, peristylepodcast.com. And now, here's the host of the Peristyle Podcast, USCFootball.com publisher, Ryan Abraham.
Hello, Trojan fans. Welcome to the Peristyle Podcast on a Tuesday. We're going to talk some USC Trojan football. We got our panel of experts here. Got Keely Yore in the studio, Dan Weber on the line. All of us, we do our jobs over at USCFootball.com. Talking about the team here on the Peristyle Podcast. We got a lot of questions this week. Now that spring football is over, kind of looking forward to the offseason, the summer workouts, some recruiting stuff, and of course, the 2019 season. What are we, 120-something days away, something like that? We'll talk about all that kind of stuff with you guys here on the Peristyle Podcast. If you have any questions or comments, podcast@uscfootball.com is our email address. Or if you'd like to call or text us, and we got some voicemails for you to play today, you can do that. 424-254-9141 is the number. We do appreciate you calling into the show, writing into the show, sending us texts, all that kind of stuff. And especially during the offseason, we want to talk about what you want to hear about during this offseason. There was some breaking news since the last time we talked. Another player in the transfer portals. We'll talk about that with all these guys. It should be a fun show. Keely, thanks for coming in. I know you're a little under the weather.
Of course, yes. I'm a little sick. I'll try and keep the sniffling to a minimum. But I'm feeling good otherwise.
All right.
She's not that good, but glad to be here, Ryan.
I gave her hookup of candy and soda, so I think she'll be all right. Yeah. And we got Dan Weber on the line. What's up, Dan? How are you?
Doing good. And kind of glad I'm here and you guys are in the studio. That's probably a good thing.
Yeah, but you're welcome to come down, but when Keely's sick, it's
yeah,
like, you
I'm
know.
I'm quarantined.
I put up a plastic shield between us. No. But it's good, yeah. So if you know, we need a cough button for Keely too.
I know,
so
we really do.
She, you know, usually she's not sick, so this is very rare. Like, she's always the peak of health.
Are you shading me right now?
Maybe a little.
How dare you?
Sorry. Don't kick her when she's down. All right, before we jump into the show, hey, wanted to thank our sponsor, Trader Joe's. They've been awesome to us over the last couple of years, doing events together, talking on the show about Trader Joe's, and they've provided us with a lot of those cool USC bags and a lot of snacks and stuff over the years. Now I'm addicted to going there a couple times a week, picking up stuff. Keely just made, you know, I made my wife like texted me like, you got to take care of dinner. So I picked up some veggies from Trader Joe's, made a little Greek salad, the feta cheese, the Trader Joe's brand feta cheese. It's bueno. That's very good. So try to do that. Pick up something to throw on the grill. But they got it all at Trader Joe's. They've been awesome to us, like I said. And if you are near USC, make sure you check out the cool one over at the University Village, USC Village. It is awesome. It's hard to believe that the students there get to take advantage of that. They can go downstairs from the dorm and walk right into Trader Joe's and buy some snacks or some goodies, whatever you want to get from there. But thanks again to Trader Joe's. They've been awesome to us. And awesome to you too, Dan. I know you love them.
I love the feta cheese. I'm a big, they're really good with all kinds of cheese, but that might be my favorite. So I'm a big feta cheese guy.
Yeah, I love the like brie. Like, I love soft cheeses, so you'll pick up some crackers and do that. So it's one of those things. I love eating those kind of things. But there's also the chocolate peanut butter cups and stuff. So I try to get the cheese over the peanut butter cups, but it's hard to do that sometimes. All right. Well, we got a lot to get to on this show. And I guess, Keely, the first thing is the breaking news. Beep, 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 beep. Like they do with the solid verbal. Matt Fink, man, didn't seem like he was going to go anywhere. He has entered the NCAA transfer portal. Kyle Bonagora, I think, put it in there first. We were able to get confirmation at 24/7 Sports that he is actually in the transfer portal. I think Kyle got some quotes from him too. Nice things to say about Clay Helton and stuff, but he's going to graduate this summer and would have 2 years of eligibility to play somewhere else. I'll start with you, Keely. What were your initial thoughts when you You heard that Matt Fink entered the portal. Not that he's gone, but he's in the portal.
I was surprised. I don't think we were expecting it. I know from our camp, it seemed like the ranking was JT Daniels and then Matt Fink and then Jack Sears. So to hear that he obviously received some news from Clay Helton and Graham Harrell that he was not in said ranking, you know, you have to assume that he wasn't in a spot that he liked. He did tell Kyle that it's not exactly permanent. He's going to feel out his options, and the timing does make sense as far as he could be a grad transfer, so he needs to get his name out there and let coaches and programs know that he's available. But I just thought it was a little shocking, just because it seemed from our perspective, from our media pen perspective in spring, that Fink was doing pretty well. So it was a little surprising, but you know, you wish Matt Fink the best in that. I thought Matt Fink was always the guy who was comfortable with being at USC, enjoyed being at USC. You know, we always talked about, okay, well, what do these guys want from their college eligibility, what they have left? And to me, Matt Fink didn't seem like the guy who was going to leave USC and try to see where an opening position would be for him outside of USC. So in that sense, it was shocking for me.
Yeah. And one of those things, it's like, if Matt Fink can transfer, pretty much anybody can transfer.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I would assume that Jack Sears would be the one to leave over Matt Fink.
Yeah.
In that term.
What about you, Dan? What do you think?
Well, I think it emphasizes in Graham Harrell's offense, the ability to throw the ball on time, anywhere on the field, on target, is really, really important. And as you know, as good a leader, you know, and great teammate and tough guy and really decent athlete and all of those things, you know, if there's one place that Matt has that may not, you know, work for him in this offense, it's that ability. You know, you kind of become a little bit of a right-handed team with Matt in there. You're probably not going to throw a lot of intermediate range stuff, the long outs and things like that. So I think where if you said who would you want as the backup if somebody gets hurt this game, you might be thinking it's Matt Fink. But who do you want as the, you know, the challenger to JT Daniels or whatever? Maybe it's not Matt Fink. There are some things you can coach up and think some things you can't. So, you know, he could go somewhere. For example, we don't know exactly when he's going to graduate. If you don't graduate until sometime in the summer, doesn't give you much time as a quarterback at a new school. But it does, since he has 2 years of eligibility, you know, he could come in somewhere immediately as a veteran backup. And still, let's say they've got a senior quarterback, and then he could be the you know, senior starter the following year, or the, you know, grad student, you know, starter. So, you know, that may play into it. He has to, you know, pick an offense and pick a school where, you know, his talents really, really fit this, you know, situation. I'm just not sure that they absolutely, you know, fit the situation as well as he does in so many areas. And as much as USC certainly loves having him, you know, as part of the team, I'm just not sure, you know, he fits this offense where you're just going to be predicated on the ability, you know, to move the ball around and get it where you want it to go and be accurate. You got to get that done. And that may not have been, you know, and as well as he did in spring, that may not have been reflected in Graham Harrell's assessment of how the depth chart looked like it might be going to play out. And Keaton Slovis's ability to deliver the ball to a lot of different places that you need it delivered in this offense may have made it a little, you know, more likely that that the depth chart wasn't going to be, you know, Matt's friend this year.
Yeah. Well, it's almost a week ago now. So I think people got used to the fact that Matt Fink's not going to be around. I mean, he could come back. He said the door was still open for that, but most likely you make that decision to go in the transfer portal, it's probably going to stick. We'll see. Obviously, he's a great kid. Wish Matt Fink the very best wherever he ends up. And, you know, maybe he does come back to USC, but we don't really think that's going to happen. I think that was about it for news, Keely. Was there anything else, or should we just kind of jump right into questions? Anything else you wanted to talk about?
I think that's it. We can jump in if you want.
Yeah, we can do that. We're going to do our live show again on Wednesday, just to let people know. Tunnel Vision is Wednesday evenings at 6 p.m. Pacific time, and we're live on Facebook, we're live on YouTube, and we're live on Periscope. You can go to uscfootball.com. We'll post links to everything up there, but we do our – it's a fun show. We just kind of chat live. We get live callers, so if you know, you like calling and leave a voicemail, you can actually talk to us live on that. So yeah, make sure you check that out. We've got a lot of callers the last few weeks, so
lots
it's been
good. Lots of
callers,
lots of questions. We love talking to y'all. It's fun.
It is pretty fun, and especially the interaction is important now. Look, just like here are the questions, because – it's going to be the off season. There's not going to be a whole lot of stuff to talk about.
It's crazy that we're already in the off season.
Yeah.
It just, where is time going, Ryan?
No, when's graduation's coming up soon, right?
May. It's like the second week of May.
Okay. So yeah, once, like after graduation, it seems like that's when they'll do more like summer workouts and stuff start. They're doing conditioning and things now. But they, like the last couple of years, like they're throwing, they've really de-emphasized that or de-emphasize it with us, at least. Like they're not trying to like publicize it. Used to be like a big deal, like they would love people to come out and watch them throw the football around. Now it's more of like a behind closed doors sort of thing. So
yeah. Where do you think Graham Harrell stands on PRPs?
That's very interesting.
That's a really good question. Yeah. I think that is the key. We haven't had a chance to talk to him about it. I would think he's the reps guy. Reps, can't get enough reps. And it's basic stuff, and they just keep doing it over and over. So it's built. I mean, basically, this is an offense that's just built for PRPs. I mean, I would just think you can't do too many PRPs, and it's not like it's the end of the world. It's just this is what you do. The way they practice. So I would think PRPs will be something that will happen. Very seriously. With a new offense, especially. I mean, I know people have, talked about how is USC going to adjust, or, it took Mike Leach 3 years to implement it at Washington State or whatever. We don't get any sense that there's been a lot of hiccups in terms of, installing this offense. I mean, you talk to coaches like Drevno, and he's pretty much amazed at how, there's a guy, did it to 49ers at Michigan, at, Stanford, for Jim Harbaugh, and like, wow, this kind of really works when you do it like this. So I think, I think summer will be important for them just to keep doing it and doing it and doing it, so they don't have to think. I think maybe more, well, I guess in different ways. I think it'll be really important for Keaton Slovis because he's a freshman. He's a young kid. Hasn't graduated. Oh, I guess he's graduated. Hasn't gone to the prom yet. The more he gets to work, the better he can make all the throws. And so it's good for him. I think for Jack Sears, I think the more work he gets in the ability to throw the ball on time, on target, he can't get too much of that. He's not going to, become a better athlete as far as working in the summer. And then for JT, I think with him, it's just let it flow. Just throw it. When they're open, just throw it. Get it to them. Don't overthink it. Don't try to maybe do all the things that you did in high school and your first year at USC when you're running a pro offense and you're a drop-back quarterback and you got to go through all of your, all the rotations, all the stuff that you got to go through. He doesn't have to do that. His job now is to, see what's there, get rid of the ball in 2.5 seconds. So I think for a lot of reasons, this could be a good summer for everybody.
I agree. And I think what we've seen over the last couple of years too, and maybe this is part of the reason why it's become more hush-hush with the PRPs, it was sort of like they were running just regular practices where they would go through. And before, there was a lot of competition one-on-ones, just like the guys going out there being familiar with each other and having fun and just trying to stay sharp. This was the last couple of years seemed more of like preparing like what they were supposed to be doing. And with, with Graham Harrell, like would go for PRPs. Okay. Receivers go run the grass and quarterbacks throw it to him. Like that's like, that's what it's going to be now. So like, you don't have to like, okay, play 17 row. It's like they're not gonna have to go through sheets. Like I think it can get back to what the PRPs were when they were fun and competitive. Because now you don't have all that complexity in there. It's really simplified, and they can just go out there and execute and do what they can. So if that's what they do, I think that's going to be a very, you know, a positive thing. And maybe it will be a little bit more open again, where they're not like kind of guarded about doing it. It's hard to go backwards, but there's definitely going to be less reason to be more guarded for the PRPs.
Yeah, I mean, I think for a baseball fan, Keeley, it's like what some of the really good hitting coaches used to do. They would say, see the ball, hit the ball. Boom. Just like that. Man, see it, hit it. Let's just get, do it. You know, don't overthink it. Don't, you know, do all the, no, just see it, hit it, you know, hit it on time, get it out there. And that's what you can do in PRPs. I mean, you don't need a coach there with you. And I think they've done it in practice every single day to the point where they maybe don't need a coach in terms of, well, what do we do? How do we do this? And it obviously helps to, you know, have a coach there. But it's the kind of thing, the way they've been teaching it, that's very transferable to a player-run practice. So, you know, I think they're good to go. So you would think, you know, they'll just go out and do what they do every day in practice. I mean, they're really good at you know, just staying with it, not trying to reinvent stuff, just, you know, make it work, get perfect.
Yeah. Sorry, Aaron. No. I was just going to say, I don't think it did them any favors to have the scripted PRPs where it was essentially, like you said, Ryan, exactly a practice, but just run by the players. Like, I think there's an element of PRPs where you're supposed to have fun and supposed to kind of make it, you know, high school where you're just kind of messing around a little bit and having fun. Because what happens is then you go straight into fall camp and you're burnt out already because you've done this practice, you know, over June and July. And so I think having that fun element, having, you know, you're playing football to play football element in PRPs and reinstituting that, I think that will be helpful for them, because I think the opposite didn't do them any favors.
Yeah. And even when you see them practice, they do that same thing that you would do in PRPs, like the walkthrough thing in the mornings before the practices, you know? So it's like, I think the burnout factor is real there. So yeah, get back to having some fun, throw one-on-ones, you know, you know, get competitive out there and be sharp, and then you go into practice and you're ready to go.
I think the interesting thing is they're doing a lot of the same things basically every day. And yet they didn't look like they were getting bored doing it.
Yeah.
Last fall, they looked bored. Practices weren't much fun. And yet they basically stuck. I mean, that was Clay's mantra, you know, when he came in and finally, you know, put Sam in, and they said, we got to, you know, just do it the same way over and over and over again. The kids look bored doing that. This year, you know, in the spring, they've done the same thing over and over and over again. They don't look bored at all. Look like they're having fun. There's a difference. And I mean, I like, you know, the direction they've gone in with Graham and the way this offense is being coached and installed. And I think what it does a great deal of good for the defense. I mean, you really have to be on your toes. You have to play fast. You have to compete, or you look pretty bad. So Clancy talked about that this offense has really helped their defense to get ready for, what is it, 9 of the teams they play this year, or, you know, have maybe not to the extent that USC is doing it, but they'll give them a lot of the looks that USC's offense has given them, and that's good for the USC defense. So, yeah, I think it's really transferable for the PRPs.
Should we roll into some questions, Keeley?
Let's roll into some questions. Michael from Newport Beach says, maybe Dan could speak to the difference between what receiver A and Y mean that I recently saw in the depth chart 2.0. Where do they line up and what is the difference? Also, what are the main alignments that we're going to see with this new offense? Thanks, Michael.
You know what? I think he said A, and I'm not even sure where A comes in. I mean, we always were X, Y, and Z. And we didn't even get to see him do the 4 wides yet. They only had 5, basically, plus walk-ons. So they stayed away from the 4 wide just because there's so much running involved. So we pretty much saw the 3 wides. Although a couple of times, you know, we did see some times where they lined up with 2 running backs that takes away one of the, you know, the wide receivers. And we did see the tight ends I think mostly look like they lined up as H-backs, but that gives them a quick release. And so, you know, if you have Josh Fallow in there, you basically, and three wides, you basically have four wides because they're giving you a look. And then you've got a running back who's, you know, going into some kind of a flare action. So, in a way, you know, you're giving them five looks. I think one of the differences is last year when you had the XYZ, you know, you have really set things you were doing with them. And I know there were people who thought, geez, whatever package they came out with who was in what position, kind of maybe gave away a little bit of what they were doing. I don't think we see that now. I think we got guys that can all line up and all three, you know, they can be the wide receiver on the one side. They can be the, you know, the wide receiver on the other side with the slot. And I think, you know, you're going to see Amon-Ra in the slot more than anybody, but I don't think it's, you know, certainly not limited to that because they can all run all the positions. And because they run, the thing about this offense that really, this passing game, is there are so many crossing routes where you have guys that lined up on the other side that all of a sudden, as the play is developing, if you've got time, it's one of those plays where you let everybody, you know, run their routes, all of a sudden you have a late-breaking wide receiver who's got some linebacker chasing him or some safety chasing him. And he's coming, you know, free on the right side when he lined up wide left. That's the stuff we hadn't seen before. So I don't know it's going to be, you know, all that terribly helpful to try to differentiate between the X and the Y and the Z and the H guy and all of that. I just think, and I'm interested in how they're going to line up when they go four wides. We haven't seen it. Going to be interesting how you're going to develop it, because you've got two of those four wides are going to be 6'5" or 6'4" and 6'5", and then you've got one who's 6'2" who can, you know, jump out of the gym, and then you got Amon-Ra. That's going to be an interesting choice if somebody has to figure out, well, now how am I going to defend each one of those guys, and they're trying to get mismatches on me with those guys. But I wouldn't be focused like in past years on who's lining up where, because they really can run lots of different patterns. And with this team, I don't think you see wide receivers who are limited by where they line up, what pattern they're going to be able to run. I mean, you know, USC's lucky. You could probably make the case that there might not be anybody in the country that has, you know, three and four better wide receivers, you know, coming back. And, they can do an awful lot with them, but yeah, I think I'd underplay, you know, the whole XYZ thing. It's just, I don't think it applies nearly as much as maybe in past years.
Yeah, and there's always different terminology for different offenses. You call it different things. I mean, when I haven't heard the A mixed in with like the XYZ before, but X and Z are essentially the outside, the wide receivers, and then the Y is like a slot guy, and the H back, right. There's things like that. But I wouldn't, like Dan said, I wouldn't get too caught up in some of the terminology. I think there's certainly routes in this Graham Harrell offense, but there's adjustments that are made, and he wants the players to run where there's no defender. So like running to grass, he wants you to be finding open spaces, and you have to be on the same page with the quarterback. So the quarterback's got to see, like, if there's a whole bunch of defenders over here, that's not where I'm going to throw it. I'm going to go to the other side where there's less defenders. And so I know this receiver is going to try to find this open spot, and that's where I'm expecting to throw the ball to. So I feel like it's a lot more of that. He doesn't want it to be super complicated. He wants, you know, just to be more of catch and throw and make the offense work and putting these athletes in positions to make plays. And I think that's worked pretty well. So yeah, I would agree with what Dan says on that, but that's, you know, it's kind of typically what those things are called. I don't know where the A came from, or if that's some mm-hmm. different term I just haven't used before.
No, I think the other thing is Graham wants you to take what's there. So, and I know this may be a little bit difficult if you think, okay, I really know this pattern and I know the coverage, and if I wait long enough, this guy is going to be open deep. And yet you get somebody open fairly quickly. I think with this offense, you'll want to go to the guy that's open right away. And you don't want to be holding and hoping. Now, I think they're going to put in some, as JT was calling them, the shot plays, where you take a shot. Okay, and then, you know, but they didn't do that in the spring. They didn't run any of those shot plays where you're really trying to set somebody up deep. So it'd be interesting to see, you know, how that works, who those guys are, and what, you know, what they do with them. But I think right now, we don't want to overcomplicate it, and that's the, obviously the message that keeps getting delivered to JT is, you know, they run the grass, you hit them with the ball. You know, they don't turn around, you hit them, you know, in something that runs with grass. And you just, you try to get the receivers thinking that if I've run the grass, that ball is coming right now. And you want them all, and it's like something, maybe it's not as easy, say, for Devin Williams to understand that there may be times where he doesn't get covered right away. He's immediately got to assume the ball's coming to me. And so that might not even be a pattern. That may just be, you know, a completion on alignment where the defense didn't get properly aligned or whatever. So you just take what I think the whole idea is to take what they give you. And make it impossible for them to cover everybody.
We have a question from Eric in Duck Country. He says, Clancy Pendergast has talked about playing fast, simplifying the defense, and rotating more players before. Do you believe him this time? Thanks, Eric.
That's a good question. And he knows we keep asking him that. and the reason we're asking him that is for the talk last year, it really didn't happen at all. You know, this was, you know, it didn't happen. Now, the guys look leaned up a little bit. They look like they're capable of playing faster. They're a year older. They're really a lot of talk about gap integrity and run fits and the kinds of things that, you know, weren't happening if you watch the UCLA game, for example. And he's got more guys, you know, to run in and out of there. So I think that's going to happen. I think we saw them, you know, going in that direction in the spring. I think they made it pretty tough for the offensive, you know, offensive guys to run the ball on them. And they got three pretty good running backs. And I don't think it was, you know, the fault of the offensive line that they just got overpowered or whatever. But I kind of believe it. Now, is the issue going to be they're holding their breath on, you know, good health in the secondary? I mean, they probably have the best top line. Like if you just grade the top five guys or the top four guys in the secondary, it might be the highest ranked secondary four deep or five deep USC's ever had. But we're dealing with guys coming off injuries and, does that hold them back? It didn't look like in the spring. I mean, they lost Talanoa, and it didn't look like it caused them to back off at all. And they just kept playing. So, I mean, I think they're moving in that direction. I think Clancy is sincerely trying to make it simpler so that younger guys can play right away. Younger athletic guys, I think we've seen that with Drake Jackson, with Raylan Goforth, with, you know, some of the guys in the secondary who've gotten a lot of chance because they've had to. I believe it, even though we haven't seen it in the fall. I think they really are trying to go that direction.
It seemed like this spring, Clay made it clear that he directly asked Clancy to change that up, whereas before, I feel like it seemed like the narrative was around Clancy doing this on his own. Do you think that changes at all now that you have Clay directly saying that he's asked Clancy to do that?
I think he did before, but I don't think it was so stated so obvious and so often. I think Clay wanted it to happen that way. I think he kind of hinted that it was going to happen that way, and it didn't happen that way. So I think it's a more public statement as to what they're going to do. I think it's they all agree. And I do think last year the defensive staff was in different places. They just didn't seem to be on the same page. They really, you know, and we didn't see it, you know, being coached up in practice either. They just looked not sure where they needed to be, and it wasn't a good look. I mean, you know, when you give up two straight, you know, two 34-0 runs with Texas and Utah, or when you give up however many yards they gave up in the UCLA game, that was just an awful, awful look for a team, you know, with the talent that USC's got. So I think they know they have to, you know, go in that direction. And I think that's Clay's job now for sure, is his job is to be the head coach and to enunciate these things really clearly. Whereas last year, you know, he's really so involved with the offense that he might be able to say it once, but it just, you know, was still totally up to Clancy. I think in some ways it's even more up to Clancy now because they are depending on the coordinators to really be the guys to put everything into place. But it's also more on Clay to say those things publicly. This is who we are. This is how we're going to play. We all agree on it. We have to do it. We hadn't heard that as much because Clay was kind of hands off with the defense.
One thing I forgot to mention at the top of the show, speaking of the defensive side of the football, former USC defensive line coach Kenichi Udeze took a job. He's working for Ed Orgeron again. He's a defensive analyst for LSU. So going from USC's defensive line coach, did not get a job somewhere else as a defensive line coach. He goes as an analyst. I don't know what you think of that, Dan, but obviously that was his first full-time assistant job, was being USC's defensive line coach. And he's going back probably to where he should have started, I guess you could say, his career. He's a defensive analyst.
That's interesting because, you know, we kept hearing things that there seemed to be disagreements about how things should be, and not just with with Clancy, but with Pete Jenkins, who visited practice one day, the D-line coach, the unbelievably well-respected NFL and college D-line coach. And we always heard that it wasn't easy for him to get on the same page with Kenichi either. So, as you say, his first job, it just didn't seem to happen last year. It just, you know, for whatever reason, and for those of us, you know, that were there when, you know, Kenichi played at USC and to know that story and, you know, how he beat the, you know, the leukemia and the NFL and, you know, was a first team All-American, one of Ed Orgeron's first All-Americans at USC, and all the things he did to, you know, lost 75 pounds after coming out of high school and accomplished so much, you know, you would like to see him land on his feet. What happened last year, I still don't think everybody knows exactly why that didn't seem to work out. But yeah, I think going with Ed, where those two are, you know, really know where the other's coming from, and being an analyst at a program that really does have, you know, terrific talent on defense, it might be the way then to get your career kind of, you know, kickstarted and all that. I think what's interesting, he didn't get another, as you say, defensive line coaching job. I thought that, you know, would say probably going the analyst route is the way to go.
Yeah, I mean, if you're USC's defensive line coach, typically, you know, like a San Jose State or someone would hire you after that. You know, not, you don't fall all the way down to be an analyst. But that, you know, there have been some criticisms of the way Clay Helton assembled the staff, and there's definitely inexperienced people getting jobs for the first time. Not that it doesn't always work out or whatever, but in this case, you know, it didn't. But I think he can learn a lot from Ed Orgeron, like you said, and build that up. And then you go from LSU defensive analyst to somewhere else to be a defensive line coach. So it's sort of like, you know, maybe it's starting over again for Kenichi if that's the path he wants to go down.
And maybe you, maybe, you know, an opening at LSU, and that wouldn't be a bad place to be a D-line coach. So
no.
Once they get to know you and they get to, you know, you get to be part of the program and all of that. I think maybe that's also an option, you know, down the road. But I think it's a good place to be. I'm glad Ed, you know, stepped up and made that possible for Kenichi. I think that's a really good thing.
All right, we got a voicemail from our buddy Curtis. Let me play it for you.
Hi, Curtis from Moreno Valley. Ryan, this is for Coach and Dan Weber. Harvey Hyde picked, he basically picked JT Daniels. He didn't pick the other quarterback because he said, I would pick Jack Sears if I didn't know who was all great in high school. If I didn't know who started last year, if I didn't know anything about any other quarterback, I'd pick Jack Sears. So he basically said he would pick JT Daniels to be the starting quarterback because he does know who started last year. He does know who was All-American in high school and all of that. Well, my opinion is that we should let whoever the coach picks be the starter. He could pick Jack Sears because of his athleticism. That's a threat. They can stop our offense if they go two deep safeties with man coverage. That'll take away pretty much everything that we do, but it's weak against the run. If you have a quarterback with that one back, we don't have a fullback. If he's a threat to run, more people have to stay home on the read option. If we do read options, I haven't seen offense. Well, yeah, we fake to the back. So a mobile quarterback is more of a threat. But a person who can make all the throws is a great threat too. But they need to let JT run. He can run. I saw him in high school. They need to let him do that read option and all other quarterbacks. That has to be a threat too. Curtis from Moreno Valley.
Hey, Curtis. I think Graham has tried to kind of tell us that running isn't that big a part of his offense and his, you know, standards for his quarterback. I mean, he said, sure, it'd be nice if a guy could scramble and get a first down every once in a while. But he really tried to tell people who were asking that question again and again that that isn't what this offense does. And that's not what this offense needs. And you would like, if you, you know, maybe you get a Kyler Murray and you think, okay, that's where we have to go because we got a, you know, once in a lifetime athlete. But even Sam Darnold, he wasn't running for first downs. He might occasionally, but you pick your quarterback for the ability to throw the ball in the right place at the right time and move the offense down the field. So I think, you know, I would not, if you read analyses of USC's quarterback situation and they fall back on, he's really a good, you know, athlete who can run. See, that may be the person writing that thought, but I don't think it's Graham Harrell's thought. He wants a guy who can deliver the ball on time, on target. It's just that simple and knows where to deliver it. And so, I mean, I look at the situation and think you have a quarterback who does a lot of really good things and he has a year of experience, really hard-earned, tough experience trying to survive in an offense that really wasn't very good. It would take an awful lot to say that quarterback who not only has a quicker release and is more accurate, and has a year more of experience to say he doesn't fit our offense, that would be kind of an upset, I think. But I don't think, you know, and people say, oh, I was at the San Diego club last night, and Graham said again that he doesn't want JT to overthink things. Well, and then he says, Jack's really a good athlete. And he said, oh, I think that opens it up. I'll be honest, I read it exactly the opposite. I think what it says is Graham is coaching JT long distance. He's telling us, he's telling boosters, he's telling everybody, I don't want JT to overthink. Because I think basically JT, you know, it's his job to lose. And I'm going to say that he can't lose it. But and I think he obviously wants Jack. Graham wants Jack and Keaton Slovis to work their tails off and really, really push JT. And he wants to be able to coach, JT up. But I don't think the running component matters. And I don't think, who would win the decathlon if they all lined up and ran the decathlon. That's not what he's looking for. I mean, he's looking for, if you want to look at all the great quarterbacks in history, if you want to go Joe Montana and Tom Brady and Peyton Manning, they're not going to win any 40-yard dash, challenges at all. But they delivered the ball to the right place at the right time. That's what this quarterback, that's who's going to be the quarterback, is the guy that does that the best. And, I can't make it any clearer, but a lot of people love the idea. I mean, the quarterback who's not starting is always the favorite. Everybody loves that guy who's not out on the field until you win, national championships with that guy out on the field. Then everybody loves him. But I just trying to, this is how I'm reading it, and this is how I would think in terms of the quarterback race.
Yeah, I agree, Dan. And Curtis, the email was a little disjointed, seemed to like kind of go all over the place. But I don't think Coach Harvey Hyde was saying he likes Jack Sears and he likes his leadership ability. He was 100% saying he thinks he should be the starter. Now, none of us here on this panel agree with that assessment, but that's what Coach Harvey Hyde was saying. But if you had gone out and watched any practices or you watched them all and you came away and someone asked you the question, like, how important was how the quarterback ran to any play during any practice? And you would have said it was a non-factor. It didn't matter at all. Now, I'm not saying it's not ever going to matter, but from whatever we watched in spring, it did not come into play at all.
Yep. Yep. I mean, and occasionally I think if Jack's in, they will run the ball with the quarterback. I don't think that, they might as well. I mean, and if they're in goal line, and Jack's in, they're going to let him, keep the ball. But they're not running, they're not running a lot of option stuff, to get the, a little bit, keep people honest and all that. But it just isn't that big a deal as we kind of see when people are trying to, read the tea leaves. It just isn't. It doesn't make that much difference at all. I mean, the premium on, quick delivery to the right guy who's open, that's the premium. That's what they're looking for.
So we have a question from Mark from St. Clemente. He says, on the final day of practice, Gerard was substituting for Dan on instant analysis with Keeley, and he seemed really concerned about the offensive line. I was hoping for some significant improvement with Tim Drevno coaching, but Gerard's comments really left me thinking we might be in a replay of 2018. Please say it isn't so. And then he says, Mark from St. Clemente, and by the way, I agree with all of you regarding JT as a starter, even being from Jack and Sam's hometown.
Ah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's not so. I mean, I think, I guess Tim Drevno said he thought this is the most athletic offensive line he's ever coached. Now, he coached at Stanford. I mean, they were pretty good. He said not the 49ers. And then he coached at Michigan, who, they didn't have a lot in some years, on offense, but people thought, they had an offensive line. He likes the offensive line. I mean, you could have four guys, not counting the center, who are basically 6'5" and a half and about 310 pounds. I mean, it's like, that's exactly what you want. Now, I mean, that doesn't mean they're all going to, play like, USC still waiting for somebody like the kid at Washington State who's going to go maybe the first lineman in the draft. And, every other year Washington State has a guy like that people are saying, where the heck did he come from? And why is USC not developing those guys? I think there's a chance this year that happens more. I like the athleticism of the offensive line. I like it that they feel comfortable that they can, give them the wide splits that work with this offense, that they've got the kind of bodies that you know, that can handle it. It has a different look. Are they going to have to work on the run game? Yeah, it's going to be playing off the passing game, and I think they worked on it enough. I think Graham believes in it enough that, and I think the running backs are good enough that when you get into the, you know, the flow of the game with the way you're going to force people to have to defend the pass, I think they're going to be able to run the ball. So, yeah, I probably don't buy in to, you know, they're not going to have a lot of guys. I mean, we really see an offensive line that needs Clayton Bradley to get healthy and Bernard Schirmer to get either healthy or get back. That needs Liam Jimmons to really develop, you know, that moving from defensive lineman, you know, to offensive lineman, and maybe the same for Jacob Daniel. You need those guys to step up and push the guys that you're seeing, you know, on that first line, and we'll see if that happens. But I'm not as negative about the, you know, the offensive line that as I guess some people are. I think they have the physical ability to play with people. You know, we'll see. It's going to be interesting. This is an interesting challenge for Drevno. This is something he hasn't done before, and he's learning as we're learning. And I think he likes, you know, what he's seeing, and he's feeling good about it. So I wouldn't, and I don't think he's just blowing smoke. I wouldn't, you know, if I didn't really think that this was the most maybe physically gifted offensive line that he's ever coached, I wouldn't say that. And he's, I don't think he's the kind of guy who would just say that just to be saying it. So I think he's seeing something there that I think they've got a chance on that first level. And if they get pushed a little bit with some competition from the second group, I think they've got a chance to be decent.
Yeah, I would say Graham Harrell said this too. Depth is probably the biggest issue on the offensive line from last year to this year. And I think the last 2 years, there was pretty talented offensive linemen for USC, but they underperformed. And I think a lot of that was on the coaching staff. I do feel this offensive line is going to perform better with Tim Drevno as the coach, even though I don't think it's as talented as what we saw last year. Dan said, you know, there's some athletic guys. There certainly is. I think there's more some unproven talent, but the depth isn't really there. But I'm not as worried about the offensive line. I think scheme-wise, it's going to help and be better. But, you know, Chuma Doga is probably going to be the first guy drafted from USC later on this week, you know, whatever round he ends up going in. I mean, he's a talented dude. He would help this offensive line. But you didn't see the kind of production from him and some of the other guys that I think were talented just because the scheme wasn't very good, and I don't think the coaching was very good. So my assessment is not as talented as we've seen the last couple of years, but still pretty talented, not as deep. But I think they'll perform better than what we saw just because of the coaching and the scheme.
We have a international question.
Ooh, nice.
From David Law, who says, greetings from vacation in France, ooh, where I listened to the recruiting podcast. It made me think of the following. If a kid like Brew McCoy is allowed to transfer and play immediately, why should he also be an initial counter for SC? If we are to pretend that he was never at SC for eligibility reasons, then SC should have the same benefit of pretending he was never at the school. Thoughts? Thanks, David Law.
Way, way, way too logical, rational, and fair for the NCAA to come up with that that reasoning. I mean, you're exactly right. Could not be more correct. And yet, you think the NCAA would do that? Think again.
It's weird. Yeah, so it's weird. USC had 25 scholarships available for 2019, but they had also had, I think it was 4 left over from 2018 that you could use. And I think when we asked Clay Helton about this, Dan, it was like Brew McCoy, he still counted, but he counted towards last year's number. But there was still an overall number, and he took one of those spots. Like if he doesn't count, like USC could bring in, and we have a question on transfers and stuff coming up. You could bring in one more guy initially, even though USC's under the 85. He took one of those spots, is my understanding, unless something had changed. But Yeah, even though if you said, well, he counted toward the 2018 one, if he didn't, someone else could come in and count towards the 2018 one. So he still took one of those spots.
Right, yeah, it's not fair. It's kind of the kind of thing that I don't even think the NCAA's figured this all out yet. You know, they tried to, well, let's, you know, give guys more freedom and more autonomy. If they want to leave, they can leave. And then, well, let's be lenient if there's a reason to let them have eligibility right away. Let's let them do that. And yet, you know, somebody gets holding the bag. And I do think players ought to have as much freedom as you can possibly have. But then maybe, and I don't want teams and coaches to be able to hold guys in place against their will, obviously. But then, you know, the schools ought to get the same kind of fair treatment. If you're bending over backwards, you know, to give kids a chance to, you know, find where they should be and where they want to be, I think you should give that same kind of, you know, deference to the schools to make them whole if that happens. And, of course, the NCAA doesn't do that.
No.
And so, you know, I mean, when you see some of the things, you know, we can get all, you know, upset with the NCAA, you know, but I mean, you don't even want to spend much time looking at like recent decisions of the NCAA, and you just, you know, end up banging your head because of, you know, they're not going to be fair, and they are kind of institutional. I mean, you know, at least recently they voted down a proposal that was going to say if a kid's a graduate transfer, he takes a slot for 2 years. And the only way you can open up a slot for the second year is if he graduates. So basically, it was a move to try to limit graduate transfers. So a kid's graduated, and they were still trying to limit his ability to transfer because they were trying to tell schools that if one of those guys comes your way, you're going to have to lock up a scholarship for 2 years, whether you need to or not, and then if he graduates, you'll get one of those years back, knowing that that would keep people from accepting graduate transfers. That's not the spirit of the way things should be done. At least that got voted down. But there's a kind of an institutional bias in the NCAA that tends to work against the individual players. Although in this case, it's going to work against USC.
Yeah.
And that's not new.
No, and so just so you know, football is a head count sport, meaning like once you count, you count. Now, Brew McCoy was not in, you know, come like August. So I don't think my understanding, Dan, is he's not going to count towards the overall number for USC, which doesn't really matter for the 2019 season. He actually would count for last year, but he still has to be an initial counter, is my understanding. So he took one of those spots that someone else that they could have brought in as a transfer or whatever could have got.
Yep.
Yeah.
And speaking of transfers, we have a transfer question, as you mentioned, Ryan. Stephen Poway says, have you heard any information on the transfer portal of students transferring into USC? It seems all we hear is news of students, like Matt Fink, trying to transfer out of USC, but very little about students transferring in. Thank you and fight on.
You know, you've heard a couple. I mean, the lineman from Tennessee. I'm trying to think, Ryan. Have we had any other visitors
the running back from Oregon, is it Taj Griffin? Like, what's his name? Is that it? There's a couple that've been mentioned, but I feel there's only one spot open, and you got the five-star quarterback Ricks from Modern Day, who could reclassify like JT Daniels. So that's the thing where they might, if they would have a chance at like say two of those three guys, there's really only a spot. My understanding, only a spot for one of them. So if Brew McCoy didn't count as an initial counter, then you could have brought in two. But there's a couple of names that come up, Steve, but it's all been transferring out, not really in. There's a chance that you could still bring in one, but I think there's only the spot for one.
But it does make you wonder, if USC has eight guys, is it eight in the transfer portal?
No, it's like 10, I think.
Is it 10 now?
Let me look.
But think about this. USC has 10 transferring out, maybe, and he has only one scholarship available for somebody coming in. If the rest of the country is even close to that, there are going to be a lot of guys in the transfer portal for a long time. It's going to be like transfer purgatory.
Yeah.
Because they're not getting out. I mean, where are they going to go? I mean, if all those guys wanted to come back to USC, they could take one of them.
Right. It's
So I don't know that they figured out the end game. I mean, if you end up in the summer and you've got, you know, 1,000 guys that don't have scholarships or anywhere to go, how do they resolve that?
Yeah, they got to go down a division or something like that. So right now, so we have on 24/7 Sports, we have our own version of the transfer portal because we have access. People, some of the reporters in our network have access to see it. So we keep a database of everybody that's in there. There's 11 guys listed for USC right now. One of them is Holden Thomas, who's a former, he was a walk-on. But they don't put Brew McCoy in there, and that's more of a database thing because if they put him in there, it's hard. You know, it's just the way we do our databases. But Brew McCoy really was at USC and is in the transfer portal. You know, transfer portal went to Texas. So there's really 11 that are in the portal scholarship players. Right now, Matt Fink does not have a destination. Trayvon Sidney's going to Illinois. Josh Metorbebe doesn't have a destination. Randall Grimes has Minnesota. Velus Jones, who took an official visit to Auburn this past weekend, no decision there. Levi Jones is going to North Carolina State. Wally Batiku, he's going to Illinois. Bubba Bolden, Miami. Akili Ross, he's doesn't have a destination. And then Greg Johnson entered the portal but came back. So, and anyone that, you know, say Akili Ross wanted to come back, he wouldn't be an initial counter. So USC could bring any of its own players back. It's just bringing in somebody new, that would be another initial counter. So I guess it's really 10 because Greg Johnson's not in it anymore. But Brew McCoy does still count for that because he was in, you know, in the transfer portal.
But then, you know, you've only got one spot. That's the amazing. And
yeah.
Here's the USC is a team that has some serious depth issues, at, as we talked about, in the secondary and offensive line and wide receivers, and yet they've got one scholarship available. So the math is kind of tricky working this math out. If you're one of those kids in the transfer portal, if you're still in there and, you know, don't have a, you know, a destination now that most of the, you know, teams are through both spring practice and their recruiting, obviously, I would think some of those people might be getting a little nervous about where this, how this is going to play out.
Yeah. Speaking of, well, this player is not in the transfer portal, but we do have a voicemail question about someone that we just haven't seen. Well, I'm kind of curious why he's not in the transfer portal, but here's a question for you.
Hey, Ryan, it's Mark Friedlander from Cincinnati, Ohio. And my question is, what happens if Daniel Imatorbebe does not play his senior season? Do you see him getting drafted into the NFL? Thank you.
Well, you wouldn't think so. That would be almost 3 years. I mean, you know, obviously we saw Jordan Simmons not too long ago, and he didn't play a whole lot more than Daniel has. I'm not sure he played anymore. And he's starting for the Raiders now or Seahawks? I'm trying to think, where the heck did he end up? I think he's going to be a starter, they think, this year. So you never want to say it's impossible, but you would think this is the year that either he's able to come back, or you would think there might be, if he can't come back this year, there might be a medical retirement, you know, in the works, you would think. I mean, we just haven't seen him. You know, it's one of those weird deals that nobody seems to have an answer for. And, you know, what a shame, because obviously he could play in the NFL, you know, with his strength and his speed and, you know, kind of a hybrid guy that, you know, can block people and get downfield and catch the ball. He would be interesting, too, if Daniel could come back like the Daniel, you know, that played, as we remember, let's say, the Washington game in Seattle. If that Daniel could come back in this offense, that Daniel would be really difficult for people. I mean, he's like a walking mismatch, period. And then you put him in this offense. But I just don't think I don't think anybody knows enough to try to predict that one. I mean, it's just, it's a mystery. It really, really a mystery. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I think it's just one of those, sometimes you run into things medically that you just don't have a good answer for.
We have a question from Dan, class of 1962. He says, have you read the Washington Post story about the resignation of Hall of Fame women's basketball coach at the University of North Carolina? An independent investigation pointed out that the conduct towards her players by making them play when injured, ridiculing them in front of the team and parents, as well as making racially insensitive remarks over a period of at least 5 years before the coach's resignation today. Who was the president of UNC during those 5 years, and where was the oversight from the president and athletic director? Does this president sound familiar, and does the lack of oversight sound familiar to USC students and alumni, as well as fans? What can we expect from our new president when faced with oversight of our athletics program? Fight on, Dan, class of 1962.
Well, you got to have a good athletic director. I think he's got to have his, you know, finger on the pulse. And I do think, and hopefully don't sound, you know, sexist or anything here, but I think it is a little bit hard at times when you have, like at USC, you had, you know, the senior associate women's athletic director was Donna Heinel, and whatever was going on with the basketball coach at North Carolina. There may be places where administrators just feel, I just don't want to go there, that it won't look right. And, you know, the North Carolina case isn't the only one where, you know, you see an out-of-control coach. And I think the thing with the men coaches, it's easier maybe to go in there and just toss them out because, you know, and it happens, absolutely. But you won't get charged with, you know, sexist, you know, behavior if you throw a male coach out, where maybe for some of the administrators and some, you know, programs, it's just easier to turn your head and hope it's not what it might be. And that may be what was going on at North Carolina. Again, I don't think you want the president, you know, involved in things like that, but you want the president to be able to really depend on that next level down. And like at USC, the athletic director reports directly to the president. You have to have an athletic director that you trust, knows what's going on, and will give you the straight story. And if you have to make a decision, you make a decision based on really good information and, you know, a sense of, you know, what's best for everybody involved here. And a lot of times maybe what's best for the student athlete isn't always, you know, a top consideration. So I think, yeah, I mean, you know, was that something you should have considered, or were there other things at North Carolina? Yeah, absolutely. Every president, I think, is in a, you know, it's not an easy job, I think, right now. And I think they knew what they wanted in a president, and I think she, you know, Carol Folt came off as the personality and the kind of person that they wanted at USC right now. How all those other things come into play, and that's where, you know, I think the focus is on say, Lynn Swann, in terms of, you know, having your, you know, sense of exactly what's going on in the athletic department and what needs, you know, what's possible and what needs to happen and how you have to approach these different things. And but the North Carolina thing illustrates, I mean, I just think, look at all the things that she had to go through at North Carolina. I mean, they've had, you know, football issues and had to get rid of a football coach. They had the whole academic, you talk about USC in the admissions scam, I'm not even close to the, you know, might get more publicity right now because of the, you got actors and lots of money, but involved. But what happened at North Carolina? And it happened before Carol Folt was the president. But, you know, the 4 years or so that it took them to get through it, of the just completely phonied up whole department and course, you know, courses for thousands of students who, you know, were basically just given grades. that really reaches to the heart of a university. And they lost their academic accreditation for at least a year, I believe, when they basically said, hey, NCAA, you can't say anything to us about academics, because not only was it a phonied up department for athletes, it was a phonied up department with phonied up classes for everybody. We had no academic standards. And the NCAA went, oh, gosh. Yeah, you're right. You know, they got away with it.
Yeah.
Good strategy. Congratulations. But, you know, there are a lot of issues out there, and you're probably not going to find a president anywhere in the country who hasn't had to deal with those. But, man, you better have good people underneath you who you can trust, who are going to give you the straight story, and they're not going to try to bury stuff so that you can say, you're going to give it your best shot. You're not going to let it go for 5 years or 10 years or however many years they let the, you know, the doctor go in the student health service. You got to respond to some of these things. And we'll see. I think I like it that she's been through some of this and has had experience in all of the things, the pitfalls and all of the tough stuff that happens. And I think that's a plus for her, but we'll see.
We have a question from Steve Sutter, who says, if and when Lynn Swann retires or is fired as athletic director, who would be a possible replacement? My recommendation, current NC athletic director or Andrew Luck's father. What do you think, Steve?
I know Andrew Luck's father really gets I'm not sure. He's a name, and he's, you know, here, there, and everywhere. I'm not sure that does it for me. We all like the Northwestern athletic director. I mean, they've got the best facilities in the Big Ten, which is almost impossible to imagine, like $270 million worth of new facilities on campus there. But he's also in the running to be the next commissioner of the Big Ten to replace Jim Delaney. So I think he's really, really good. We mentioned the North Carolina case. I mean, I always thought that, you know, you had to, if you were Carol Folt, you had to take a look at Bubba Cunningham, who was your athletic director, who got you through some, you know, tough things at North Carolina. He's a Notre Dame graduate, you know, 15 years he worked in the, you know, athletic department at Notre Dame. He would be kind of a, you know, you got a big time private school linked at the hip since the 20s with USC. You would think you would take a look, you know, in that direction. I would have thought they would have taken a look in the direction of the Arizona AD, Greg Byrne, I guess, who's now the AD at Alabama, and I think was very close to getting the USC job at one time. But I think professionals who've proven themselves in this very competitive business and bring somebody in like that who understands what you have to do and how you have to do it. I think USC, not only do they have to get USC squared away, USC has to become the leader in the Pac-12. USC, the Pac-12 needs somebody to be the leader. And I think the logical choice and the logical candidate over all the years has been USC. I think USC has to restore itself to that position where USC just isn't one of the, you know, the followers and sitting back in the Pac-12, but where USC, takes a leadership role. We haven't seen that in years. But as far as names, I just like guys who've proven they can do it and as athletic directors in this very difficult business that that USC's. It's really competitive, and I don't know that USC people right now think it's really competitive. I don't see that, you know, feeling of we got to go out there, we got to have better ideas, we got to work harder, we got to do this. I think they just, it's like we got to keep our heads down. This is a really cool place to work. And we're USC. Did you know we're USC? Yeah, we're USC. No, that's not what USC needs.
No, Steven, I agree. It, you know, this is, I don't know when it's going to come to an end, but it's three former football players in a row is too much. Like Dan said, we had heard Greg Byrne from Arizona was interested and USC could have hired him. He goes to Alabama and USC gets Lynn Swann. So that's the kind of decision-making you're talking about, where instead of going out and getting the experienced guy, you go out and get the guy you know who's going to be the face of the program. That has to stop. So I haven't looked a lot of, candidates lately. You're talking about Oliver Luck, he's the CEO of the XFL, and that's starting up in 2020, I think, or whatever. So I wouldn't think that he's going to leave something like that. Bubba Cunningham, someone Dan already mentioned. For me, you just got to follow my rules. If you just follow my rules, everyone would be fine. One, he has to be good at the job you're going to hire him for. So that means he has to have been, an athletic director. So someone that's an athletic director that's running a big sports program and has had success. That's not that hard, right? Find someone that's doing that. Two, don't know the fight song. So they can't have USC ties. So that if USC followed those rules for the past decade, I can't even tell you, like, they'd probably have a couple of national championships in football. Everything. All that stuff would be better. But USC doesn't hire that way. So you have to completely reverse the thinking and pretty much do exactly the opposite of what USC's been doing lately.
No question. I mean, it's just, I think the thing that we see missing is the idea that you have to compete. And the one place USC is competing is they're probably paying their athletic directors more than anybody in the country. And you don't know, for what purpose, what are you getting out of that kind of expenditure? And it doesn't make any sense. And when you say, I know this guy, I have no idea if he can do this job, but I know who he is. No, it's got to be the other way around. I know he can do this job. He's done it. How many guys who are athletic directors in the Pac-12 would just love to come to USC and say, man, if I could have access to what they've got access to. I mean, if you're, sitting at the University of Arizona, you think, whoa, what could I do at USC? That's who you're looking for, that guy. Or the guy at Northwestern who says, man, look what we've done here at Northwestern. What could we do at USC? But always with that, what can we do? What can we do? How do we get this done? And, I mean, the idea that USC for two straight years couldn't figure out how to get a place to play their spring game or how to play a spring game, I mean, that's – how do you not have a deal going with the L.A. Football Club Stadium that you could use that stadium? I mean, come on. Did they really sign an agreement to let them have all that property – take up all that space without a deal where USC could use that stadium when they needed it? I mean, come on. That's terrible. You can't have those things fall through the cracks, because I'm guessing, USC probably could have told the LA Football Club, if we let you build a stadium here, we're really going to need you to give us some access to it if we need it. Just things like that. What do you do to – and then work real hard to sell tickets and promote it and have fun with it and all that. And it just often seems like that part of it, they just let go through the cracks. Just the idea that, the city section semifinals that were played always at, Dedeau Field or for recent years, and that they raised the rent from $2,000 to $19,000 or whatever. And, city section schools walked away from USC. That's not a good look. USC can say, oh, the rules changed, or it's not the athletic department, somebody else is doing it, or we need... No. The athletic department has to have a position there. And they can't let people who are not in athletics be turning people away from being on campus. And creating some, unsatisfied, people in the community. I mean, it's a community event that USC should want to have on the field. And you can't just say, oh, well, somebody else on campus made a decision, nothing we can do. No, get involved. And you know, too much of that has happened.
Yeah, one of the most disturbing things that just, and I've thought about this a lot, but this really never occurred to me until, Dan, what you were just saying. You know, we look at the Pac-12, and Larry Scott is the highest paid commissioner and the lowest performing. So we've seen this with USC, the past couple of athletic directors. They have the highest paid athletic director in the country, most likely, certainly with Pat Hayden. Lynn Swann's probably close if he's not the top, and the worst performing. And you wonder, like, so when you went out and got the inexperienced guy, why shouldn't you get that guy at a bargain, not pay them the most money that anyone's ever paid an athletic director before, like Pat Hayden? And I think it was USC just wanted to get their people so badly. And those people were like, yeah, that's not really the job for me. You had to like pay them a lot more money to justify your horrible decision. Instead of just going out and getting, you could have got David Byrne for like half of what you got Pat Hayden for, you know, someone that's way better and cheaper. But you wanted your former USC football player so bad that you had to pay them more money. It's just baffling to me. The decisions that were made were horrible, and on a number of levels, because there were horrible decisions for personnel-wise, but then you had to pay them a lot more money just to convince them to take the job. It's like baffling to me.
Yeah, because it was always, I don't know if I want to do it. I don't know. It's a, you know, that's going to be, people are not going to be happy. So you had to convince them by upping the ante. It was like, this is insane. But I don't think it'll happen again. I don't think it'll ever happen again.
Never
but
say
we'll
never.
So we have one final question from Dan, class of 1962. He says, now that spring football is finished and the basketball season has ended, can you discuss the strengths and weaknesses of the spring sports? USC could possibly earn NCAA championships in women's track and field, beach volleyball, women's and men's golf, and women's water polo. Men's volleyball has improved greatly as well. What do all these sports have in common? Great coaching. The greatest loss from the Mission scandal was the firing of Jovan Vavic, the best water polo coach in the country, I would argue, ever. That's me jumping in. The exception is baseball, one of the traditional winning sports at USC. Please give us your assessment of the baseball program, and kudos to the other spring sports. Fight on, Dan.
Well, you got to give baseball credit. I mean, it looked like they were taking the, you know, absolute, you know, they looked like the Angels there for a while, and then all of a sudden, they're really fighting back.
Yeah, come on, Dan.
Hey, for us Orange County people, and one of us who actually covered the Angels for a number of years, I don't even know who they are. So anyway, that's but USC baseball, I give them a lot of credit. They're fighting back. And yet, I will never agree that USC baseball ever could. I mean, USC baseball is the most distinguished baseball program historically in the NCAA. And yet, because there are so many great programs in Southern California where you can be seen, you know, every guy that plays college baseball thinks they're going to go to the major leagues. There's no advantage to playing at USC over anybody else. It's all disadvantage. The history doesn't matter at all. But the tuition does, and you know, the fact that you're allowed to have, 11 and a half scholarship, whatever it is, and you need about 30 or 35 players, baseball is screwed. So and they are allowed to divide up scholarships, so you're way better off if you, you know, want to be seen and maybe want to go to the college. I mean, you can go to the College World Series from UC Irvine, from UCLA, from Cal State Fullerton, you know, Long Beach State, you could, you know, at least four, probably you could almost include Pepperdine there. It's way more difficult for USC baseball to really compete. You just don't have enough, have enough scholarships, and the cost of tuition at USC is just so high, and there's no advantage to going to USC. So I think they're doing as well as they can. I'm glad they kind of righted themselves and are moving in the right direction. And the rest of the sports, basically, they are still, you know, part of that USC tradition. You know, that Carol Smith, you know, Gilbert does an unbelievable job with track. And it's difficult, again, they don't have enough scholarships. When you go to the men's track meet with UCLA, UCLA's got like three times as many bodies. And USC, you know, still has a chance to, you know, to win, and will do much better when they get to the Nationals, because, you know, it's just not a dual meet. And they look like they've got a heck of a shot to win the women this year. And the men, what, they jump up 28 spots or something this last week to, you know, top 10. So, you know, and they've got athletes that are really interesting. You watch Michael Norman, who, you know, turned pro, but still training with them, and ran the, you know, the fastest, you know, 400 in the world last week. And just a lot of special athletes in so many sports. And that's, they're in sports where USC has had a historical advantage, and they've kept it. And they just said, you know, the other difference, though, is maybe other programs don't compete quite as hard as they do in football and basketball. Football and basketball really, really matter, you know, to a lot of schools that spend a lot of money. I'm not sure the rest of them, maybe it more depends on, you know, how good is your coach? How much tradition do you have? Are there enough scholarships in that sport so that USC's tuition doesn't really work against you? And you got to give them credit that, you know, where a coach has the ability to compete at USC, they're mostly competing, and you know, good for them. You wish that was able to, you know, be transferred to the whole program, the whole department. And but it's a bright spot. There's no question about it. And yet the sports that USC spends the most money on, certainly with football, has the most tradition, are the sports, and that's where there's the most competition, and you've got to do the most things right, are the sports where they haven't seemed to figure out how to do that. Now, is basketball, because it's going to, you know, the whole recruiting profile changes for next year, are they going to be able to coach them up and all of that? I'm seeing now people are saying, you know, USC might be top 25 next year, and, you know, John Wilner, I think, picked them to go to the, you know, Sweet 16. We'll see. But good for the spring sports. Now that baseball has looked like they turned a corner, you know, they're a bright spot, and good for them.
I don't know about baseball turning a corner, Dan. They're 17-20-1. They did win a series against Arizona State.
I think they were 10-17. So to me,
they're coming back.
17-20. They're better. I mean, I thought 10-17. Where is this going? And then they knocked off Arizona State a couple of times.
Yeah. I think the problem was, Chuck was talking about it. They went on the road to play Utah, and he's like, that's a series they should sweep. And they lost the series. It was like they won one and lost two. So I guess Utah was pretty terrible. I'm not following college baseball, but it doesn't, you know, they still got Oregon State series. You know, I don't know if this team's going to be able to finish above 500. And then for the first time since like 1950 or something, right, you have losing.
All three.
Yeah, all three, baseball, basketball, and football, all with losing records. But I think they've made some sort of comeback, but that Utah series, at least from what Shotgun was saying, that's one they should have swept, and they lost the series.
I think the snow threw him off.
Was there snow? I don't even know, but I just remember him saying that.
There might have been some snow involved.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
I remember, but yeah.
I, you know, it's like, it's not the greatest praise when you say, hey, we're not still 10-17. You know, okay, you're not.
True.
You wouldn't want to be out there trying to handicap their games. That's for sure.
But there's traditional programs that are scholarship limited, like you mentioned, baseball and track, where so on the podcast of champions, they were asking, like, what's USC's most famous, you know, the question was about the biggest Olympic sports or non, you know, super revenue sports for each school. We asked the publishers from all the different, from all the different programs, and for USC, you know, probably the most or close to the most in track. They won a lot, but that was a long time ago. Certainly the most national championships in baseball than anybody. You know, you look at water polo, just what you've been able to do the last couple of decades, like those would all be candidates. at, you know, water polo you can get in people, but like with track and baseball, it's hard at a private institution that's one of the most expensive in the country. I think with the big endowment that USC's built up, could they do something like what Stanford does? And if you're under a certain income, you have you're going to school for free. So it's almost like these free scholarships for all these different Stanford sports based on that. And if I'm not mistaken, I think that's how that works.
Yeah, you're correct. I mean, and Stanford has like 30 sports. USC's got 21. But their endowment is so much more than USC's. I mean, I don't know if it's five or six times, you know, where if USC's got $5 billion or whatever, and Stanford's 30. I mean, I'm totally just pulling numbers out of the air. But Stanford just has enough endowment that if your family makes under $100,000 a year, basically you will not have to pay tuition at Stanford. So and since it applies to all students, that means all athletes. So they have the ability to get athletes in at Stanford, you know, on full scholarships, basically, if their family makes under $100,000 a year. USC is so far from being able to do that. I mean, it's a tremendous edge, you know, for Stanford. It's why they win the, you know, the all sports, whatever that, I can't think of that word, all, you know, who sponsors it, but that all sports award every year, Stanford wins it. They basically have, you know, more going for them. They can recruit more kids than the limited scholarships allow them to. So, you know, where Stanford might have 25 baseball players on scholarship or 30, and USC have, you know, 11 full scholarships. It's just it's a much more difficult thing for USC to do, and it's the one area I think. And the other part of that equation is Stanford has a much smaller undergraduate student body, so you don't have to provide as many overall dollars for the student body than you would at USC, because there are so many more undergraduate students. So it's a really tough deal for USC. But yeah, if USC had the same deal as Stanford, where every kid, you know, undergraduate who you know, his family makes under $100,000, the composition of the rosters in a lot of those sports would look really different. But that, you know, that's not going to happen, probably.
No, yeah, that makes sense. Looks like Stanford's endowment's $26.5 billion, and USC's $5.5 billion. But
wow, I wasn't that far off.
No, okay. Yeah, USC raised though like $6 billion just in the last. So I think they bumped up the endowment.
And some of that goes to the endowment. Some of that's going to endowment. Some of it's going to scholarships, that kind of thing. But yeah, Stanford's in another league, and then they have far fewer students, undergrads, to distribute that to, as opposed to USC. And there are people who argue, oh, USC shouldn't have gone to you know, such a larger undergraduate student body. But then the flip side of that is, if you have 5,000, you know, international students, and let's say those 5,000 are all paying $60,000+ a year, cash on the barrelhead, you know, USC goes into the year with a whole lot of money in the bank. That makes a big difference to have all those, you know, international students. But to do that, you have to enlarge the undergraduate student body, you know, considerably. And that's what USC has chosen to do. And, you know, people argue both sides of that, whether that was a good idea or not a good idea. But USC, I'm guessing USC, of the really elite universities, USC probably has the largest undergraduate student body. I mean, you know, the Notre Dames and, you know, Northwesterns and schools that would be somewhat comparable, the private schools, certainly, Stanford, don't have anywhere near the number of undergrads that USC does.
Yeah. That's all we got, Keely?
All we got. We went pretty long today.
It's pretty, yeah. I mean, look, man, we, lots of good questions, lots of good topics. Man, hour and a half. How the heck did that happen?
I know. Off-season podcast.
Off-season podcast. It was good. Yeah. Our Pac-12 podcast yesterday, like, we didn't have any guests. It was just me and Dave, and we went over like 2 hours and 15 minutes. It was crazy. Yeah. But there was a lot of like topics people sent in and stuff. They know, like, the off season, they need to keep it going. And that's, I think, our listeners do too. It's the off season. Send us some questions, you know, leave us a voicemail. If you leave us a little longer voicemail in the off season, we'll probably play it. You know, that was Curtis's was like almost 2 minutes. Like, eh.
What about basketball, Ryan?
No. We talked baseball. Okay. Like, I don't, you know, it's, they gotta finish above 500 for me to talk about them. You know, like this is not, I'm not gonna talk about, you know, if it's outside of football, you better be good. And they're not good. So
wow.
Yeah. They're not. Like
True.
We'll see if they're good this year, but they're not. So, yeah, don't send in your basketball questions. I will ignore those. All right. Well, I guess that's going to wrap it up. That's Sick Keely over there.
Apologies for the coughing and sneezing and sniffles.
We feel bad for keeping us on. Dan Weber, thanks again, Dan.
Enjoyed it. Very good. The questions going in all different directions, and that's great. It's not like the Pac-12 or USC have any problems to deal with right now that, you know, we talk about, because I think we at least get the right questions, and we've always said that maybe that's some of the problem at the Pac-12 and USC. They're not even sure what the right questions are. It's really hard to come up with those answers, but I think our questions are pretty good. Now, whether we're getting all the right answers, I don't know, but I think we got good questions.
And we will always answer your questions no matter what. You know, unlike the Larry Scotts or the Lynn Swans of the world, we'll sit here. We'll answer your questions. We'll throw the hardest ones that you got at us, and we'll make sure to do our very best to answer them. All right, well, that's Dan Keely. I'm Ryan. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Peristyle Podcast, and we will talk to you next time.
You may have noticed that shopping at Trader Joe's is unlike shopping at other markets. People ask us all the time how we manage to have such unique, interesting, and delicious products at such great everyday prices. This is Dan Bain of Trader Joe's. The answer is simple. It's all in the way we do business. We buy directly from the manufacturer whenever possible. This helps to keep our costs low, and we pass those savings on to you. No gimmicks, just great values at honest prices every day at Trader Joe's. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the Peristyle Podcast, presented by USCFootball.com. Be sure to tune in next week for the latest news on Trojan football and recruiting. And don't forget, you can automatically download the podcast directly to your smartphone or tablet for free. Just click the iTunes link on PeristylePodcast.com or search for Peristyle Podcast at the iTunes Music Store.